All right, we're gonna go ahead and start 7 seconds early. Welcome to our final session. This is a roundtable, which is a little bit different than the panels. I'm Maurice Lee, professor of English, and I'm gonna quickly frame what we'll be doing for the next hour and 15 minutes, and then I'll introduce our speakers. So our charge today as a roundtable seems simple enough. We were supposed to attend all the panels and listen to all the discussions, and then formulate and synthesize some ideas in real time to try to wrap up what's been a very productive day of discussion and papers, I think. We won't tie up everything, of course. There's too much to talk about, but hopefully we'll bring some order and focus to what's happened today and point towards further discussion, which, of course, will include you all. So it seemed very easy at first, largely because we didn't have to write papers ahead of time. and so that sounded great, but while you were enjoying your cookies and brownies, we've been frantically working to organize our thoughts, put them in order. It's a little bit like being an undergraduate on the night before a paper's due.
Law student.
Yeah, exactly. But I also think that this process models a kind of good approach to dialogue. At most conferences, you put your paper together ahead of time. You come in fully armed with your thoughts fully formed, and you're prepared to defend your position, which is one way to exchange ideas, but is maybe less open. Less open to change, less corrigible. So our panelists or our roundtable participants today will probably be thinking more on the fly than normally, and it's risky to do this, which I also think is appropriate for the topic that we've been focusing on today. True dialogue is risky. We risk being wrong. We risk looking stupid. We risk being offended or being offensive. We might suffer retaliation, regret. One thing that I've noticed in a lot of the panels today, there are lots of mentions of fear and trauma and retaliation, danger, precarity, unpredictability. But as the as economists and artists will tell you, risk is also good. Risk has an upside. And I think the kind of open dialogue we've been engaging in today and hopefully will continue to engage in opens up possibilities for kind of deeper understanding, different sorts of knowledge than we might get in the normal conference format. It's imperative that we take these risks today in higher education and particularly in the humanities. It's no coincidence that many of our discussions and papers today turn towards everyday practices of classroom teaching. The humanities, the dialogue is central to the humanities, and the kind of open dialogue that we foster is central to the humanities. I think people have been taking risks today. We talked about the difficulty of teaching controversial texts. We had people speak truth to power. We had high-level administrators come and participate in this forum, which I think is also a kind of risk for them. We talked about retaliation, about sharing personal struggles and addressing structural inequalities. We talked about power relations and hierarchies that we often would prefer not to talk about at the university level. And those have been made more visible today. We have some great people today to help us continue to take risks, I hope. I'll read their names very quickly. Julie Levy, a PhD candidate in the Department of Classical Studies. David Lyons, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Philosophy and School of Law. William Moore, Director of the American and New England Studies Program. Adela Pineda, Professor in the Department of Romance Studies. Carrie Preston, from Killichan College and Director of the Killichan Honors College. I'm going to turn it over to them, and as with our other forums or other panels today, we'll have lots of time for questions in the end. So please.
Hi. I'm a PhD candidate in classical studies. This is not the sort of place that you wind up if you have doubts. We've talked a lot today about the liminal space that is being a graduate student, and it's come as a surprise to some, I think. And it's come as a balm to those of us who live in it. We exist in that tension between the idealized living the dream of being a scholar. We aspire to become more knowledgeable. And we try, most of us, not all of us, to become faculty. But those jobs don't necessarily exist. And those jobs are not necessarily what we are either trained or compensated for doing. There is this tension between our labor, our very real labor, teaching classes, doing research, the things that faculty are paid for, and the fact that we are treated as students. We are colleagues, but we are not full colleagues. There has to be some consideration of the realities of people living in this situation. And I think that, you know, we've brought several times the union to the table. That's a good step. And that's not just for us. I'm glad that there's a union for adjuncts in the mix. And I'm saddened to hear about other marginalized groups within the university. Universities have, in a lot of ways, as was mentioned on the corporate panel, taken a lot of the wrong lessons from the corporate world. They have, and BU has in some cases, taken this idea that, oh, we should be public-facing, getting our funding, we should be showing that we want diversity, that we want to adapt to the modern living conditions, want to adapt to the world, but we haven't really fully taken on the structures that are necessary to support that kind of thinking. There needs to be clarity. There needs to be structure for that. We need to reject simplicity and superficiality where it winds up hurting the people who are members of our university and our community. I have been told as a teacher that I should not be political. But any student of the classics should know that no text is apolitical. I think it's irresponsible not to take these things into account. I'm so pleased to be part of the discussion wrapping things up today, where we've heard so many perspectives that I think really need more consideration. Thank you.
A couple of people have commented that the adjuncts haven't been represented so far. We are now represented. That will be my theme, the situation of adjuncts in the university. I'll start on a slightly different point. If you've been following the news, especially the labor news lately, you will know that about 45,000 General Motors employees are on strike. And one of the reasons they're striking is because they have a three-tier system in General Motors. Three tiers that correspond to some of the tiers of our faculty system here. We have many more tiers than, of course, faculty, but even within the faculty. They have full-timers who are fully paid. They have a lower tier who are paid at lower rates. This was a concession that was made several years ago before General Motors got a $50 billion subsidy from the federal government, and has been making billions of dollars a year. And they have a bunch of temporary workers who have very low wages and no benefits. Those three tiers correspond roughly to some of the tiers of the faculty. And of course, this is to ignore, for present purposes, just temporarily, the other elements of the university that we've been talking about, the administration, the staff, graduate students, undergraduates, who represent other tiers in the university who have little or no voice to, within the governance of the university. At BU, we can think of the tenured faculty as being a tier, the tenure track but not yet tenured faculty as being another tier, because they are much less, what's the word I'm looking for, secure. Non-tenured, tenure-track faculty are vulnerable. And then we have full-time contract faculty, one of whom was on the last panel, who are working under contract. 300 or so of them are now unionized, same local as the adjuncts are. And we have part-time faculty. Very low wages, no job security, generally speaking, with some exceptions, appointed on a semester basis, no benefits, except for a few rare exceptions, and no voice within the university, which is perhaps, relative to what we've been talking about today, one of the most significant aspects of it. Without the union, they have had absolutely no leverage. Let me go back a step. I was a full-time faculty member at BU for 20 years, until 2015 when I formally retired. Before that, I was a full-time faculty member at Cornell University for 31 years. So I have some experience of being a full-time faculty member. When the Service Employees International Union approached me 4 or 5 years ago to help generate faculty support for the unionization of adjuncts at BU, I knew absolutely nothing about adjuncts at BU. And I think that's true of at least 99% of other full-time faculty. They are a hidden minority, but a very substantial minority. The bargaining unit, so-called, which now is represented by Local 509 of the Service Employees International Union, has almost 700 members, 25% of BU faculty. That's a pretty substantial body that has virtually no voice in the university. With rare exceptions, they have no offices, no standard place to meet with students. They are not paid for the time that they spend outside the classroom. And for the time they are in the classroom, they are paid poverty wages. Given the new minimums under the 3-year contract that recently expired, the best, if someone were being paid at the minimum level and was teaching a 4-credit course at that level and was teaching 3 courses a semester, be making $25,000, roughly. Very few adjuncts teach 3 courses a year. Most adjuncts teach 1 or 2 courses a year, I think it's fair to say. Some teach more. Some minority of the adjuncts have full-time jobs. That would be true, for example, in the law school. My guess is it's also true in the business school. It's not true in the College of Arts and Sciences, for example, or in the Met College, or in the College of General Studies. So, we are now in the process, supposedly, of bargaining for a new contract. The first unionization drive was successful, clearly I think it was something like a 2-to-1 vote on the part of the adjuncts. And we bargained successfully over a period of months, 3 years ago, and we had a 3-year contract. We then, in anticipation of the expiration date of August 1st, prepared last year, beginning last fall, to canvass our members to determine what were most important items that they were concerned about and that we should place the highest priority in our bargaining. And we were prepared to initiate bargaining for a new contract last winter. And we tried to initiate it. Boston University refused. In fact, they held off scheduling bargaining sessions with us until August, after the contract had expired, and we agreed to a 1-month extension of the contract. We actually met twice during August. There were more meetings scheduled for August than those two, but they were all canceled by Boston University. We agreed to another 1-month extension, and that was September. BU scheduled no bargaining sessions with us during that month. So we have a problem. We have extended the contract by mutual agreement another month. This won't go on forever. We do have some bargaining sessions scheduled, and I hope that we have a more positive attitude on the part of Boston University than has been evident in the past half year, because the only proposal that they made so far has been an anti-union proposal. I won't go into the details unless you ask me. I think I've taken enough time, so I'll stop here now.
Thank you.
So, as we were drinking coffee and gathering outside, my train of thought went someplace quite different, which, that's part of the multitudinous nature of the university. And I'm trained as an interdisciplinary scholar, which means that I get to steal data and methodologies from wherever I want to use them. So in pulling together what I was thinking about today's talk, I thought I'd, try to camp out a little bit in history, a little bit in sociology, and then maybe with Susan, trespass on Susan's English expertise. What I'm thinking about from history is that it's always useful to think about change over time and to think about where we came from to where we're getting to. And today we're talking about the contemporary academy, but we have to recognize that the university as a whole, the university system in which we participate, is an august and ancient institution. Whenever we get up and dress up in our formal gear at the university, we wear these ridiculous outfits that look like Hogwarts because we want to do obeisance to the fact that we're ancient. And my one of my department chairs used to love to say that the university predates capitalism, right? It's an essentially pre-modern institution. So I think that if we steal kind of the classical French sociologists' ideas about modernization theory and how modernization took place first in the Western world and then in the globe more broadly, it's useful to think about how we got to where we are in the contemporary academy. And I'm thinking specifically about what the French sociologists used to talk about as the transition from a Gemeinschaft to Gesellschaft, or from community to society, and how that transition went from communities that were basically homogenous and that shared values, and in which discipline was enforced informally by the community through through peer pressure or through shunning. To Gesellschaft, which is society, where you've got a heterogeneous community that does not share all the same values and that has to get along, and which has to have rules and agreements and a legal system to enforce discipline and proper behavior. And if we just go a little bit further to this, you know, if we go back to the medieval universities, you know, which of course we have romantic visions of them, but there's some that romance is based in some reality. It was, first of all Western Europeans, right? It was all males. And many of them were studying philosophy and theology, and they had that in common. And at the same time, the most important relationship in that university was between the instructor and the student, right? And it was that one-to-one teaching that brought people to the institution, and that mentorship, which was important. And the teacher was given great authority over how they were supposed to teach because nobody knew their field better than the instructor did. So through the whole modernization process, you know, and I think these are things that we've been talking about throughout the day, you know, how do we impose modernization upon this ancient pre-modern pre-modern institution that's based upon the relationship between the instructor and the student, right? And now we're dealing with issues of equity and inequality and individualism, which comes out of the Enlightenment, right? We've talked about how do we accommodate the ancient university to capitalism, and then even more to corporatism and a bureaucratic control of the capitalist system. We've talked about governmental regulation and the importance of making sure that the relationship between the student and the instructor can be regulated by other groups that are passing laws. We've talked about how the university system, which was originally about theology and worldview and maybe languages, has now become job training and instrumentalism. And over again, we've talked about policies that are constraining individuals for the good of the entire corporation, but also for the good of the individuals, even though these policies may go against what the instructor thinks is in the best interest of the student. And that's possibly because it's protecting the student from the instructor. And I think that we've... there have been resonances of this bubbling up in our conversation already. I don't think I made this up completely. Going all the way back to Susan talking about how Huck and Jim going down the raft, you know, you can see Huck as the student and Jim as the instructor, keep running into the Duke and the King, right? So these symbols of the pre-modern, of the nobility and the hierarchy that Huck and Jim are trying to reject. But we've also heard Peter Schwartz talking about moving from John Silber to the post-Silber administration as being going from feudalism to a rights-based self-government, right? So again, how do we have, as a university, make sure that people are involved and have the ability to participate? And we've heard Kimber talking about how graduate students are supposed to be going through an apprenticeship. And again, an apprenticeship is a pre-modern kind of economic structure. So I think what I'm moving towards is that what we're talking about today and what we're troubled by and what we're trying to figure out is how to take the best aspects of the august and ancient institution that we're involved in, which is about exploring the world and understanding ourselves better and understanding the world around us better, while also throwing out and doing away with the parts that are problematic and somehow trying to fit it into this modern context, which I think we can all agree with. Provost Williams talked about how diversity creates a better product. And so bringing diversity into the university, making sure that it's not just male, that it's not just white, that it's got people of all economic classes involved, is going to make it a better university. But in doing that, it's a process of conflict and growing until we get there. So that's what I've been thinking about today.
Well, first I want to start thanking the Humanities Foundation, Susan Thompson and her team for this invitation. And also to say that from a personal level, I must say that I am grateful to be you, and not just the institution, but for the people I've met here. I have made my career here, and I have flourished here, I can say that. But like throughout the day, I have seen something that I see a divide between what you said, community and society, and let's say these goals to portray education as a place where we can share and debate ideas within a context that is highly bureaucratized. And it's bureaucratized because of the model of the university that is more corporative, and it's getting there more and more. So at an existential level, I think the three panels are addressing a very important problem that I think we have to look ahead, which has to do with how we feel satisfied with what we are doing for the others and for ourselves. And in the classroom, when we present difficult texts, the question comes, am I self-censoring? I'm not going to say this or that, or I'm not going to put this text in the curriculum because I think I'm going to offend students, or because there is a regulation that might put myself at risk. So I think these dialectics between the idea that you are acting on behalf of the good of your students, but at the same time, you're actually being obedient to a system that is going beyond your control, is something that we are experiencing today. And I think in the future, we have to address this question. I'm not an economist, and I learned a lot today about how complex it is to manage a university of this size. But I am a professor of literature, and when they talk about safe space, I was very interested in listening to this idea of brave space. And I would say also kind of like freedom, like literature was a place where you could speak freely, because, you know, like if you think of literature in an idealistic way, you think of literature as a place where you are being anti-institutional because you are building on ideas that are beyond the constraint or of certain mainstream ideas. And this you can convey to students or colleagues within the frame of ideas. And I value that because this is the way I became a literary scholar. I could have studied engineering. I started studying engineering when I was growing up. But I wonder if this is going to be possible. And I know this dialectics is very complex because on the one hand, the university is becoming more diverse and more inclusive, and I am a woman, and I am Mexican, and I am here. But on the other hand, it is also becoming more and more difficult to really feel that you have a community. And when you say community, is when you can establish concrete goals with very concrete people that you are talking to. I was very impressed, and you know, with the graduate students' participation in these panels, because one of the most important jobs I think I have in this university is my relationship with graduate students. I have had spectacular graduate students, students who have changed my way of thinking, my way of teaching, my way of addressing topics that go beyond what I teach. And it is terrible that they, who are great thinkers and are potential famous scholars, have to work in very precarious conditions. I don't know how you can address this question, the student labor divide. I think this is a question that has to be addressed very seriously by the university and by the authorities of the university, because I think the motor of a research institution are the graduate students. In my department, the graduate students, they have the basement of the building, and that building floods very often, and this is the conditions are not appropriate for students who are also instructors. So I learned a lot from them today, and I guess the last thing I want to say is that I direct an interdisciplinary center. It is the Center of Latin American Studies, and I agree with Provost Kleiman about how important it is to see your discipline across other disciplines. I am very, very privileged to be able to dialogue with faculty and students from political science, history, philosophy, etc., because I understand the role of the humanities better. But I also see that certain regions are still underrepresented at BU, and I would say that the case of Latin American studies is one. We have very few resources if we compare ourselves with other centers at the university, and it is not easy to get those resources. We have the chicken and the egg problem, because they say, well, if you don't bring resources, we cannot give you resources, but I don't get resources because we're too small. So, you know, yeah, that's what I have to say about Latin American studies. Thank you.
So I have a very strong impulse to reintroduce myself. When my esteemed colleague in the English department, Mo over here, introduced me as being from Kilichon Honors College, I realized with some alarm that I represent the administrator position on this panel. And so I wanted to reintroduce myself as a professor in the English department in the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies program. But I think it's actually really important that we think across those divides, my own divided identity, which Daniel Kleinman spoke to earlier. And thinking to the title of this whole day, Can We Talk? I think the answer is very clearly yes, in capital letters, followed by a big but. We have a lot of work to do. I believe if we can't talk about something, we can't figure out a way to solve that problem. So I've been particularly excited to hear and surprised to hear from staff and graduate students, and I think it's to the brilliance of the organizers, Susan, Tamsin, everyone, that you brought this group together, because I'm much more familiar with the divide that I'm straddling as a faculty member and an administrator, and I think it was really, really important that we heard from graduate students and staff members today. So that's part of the but. I also wanted to go back to the morning session, because I thought today would be much more about the tension. I should also introduce myself as being on the Free Speech Task Force. On the other side, Brother Larry is on the implementation side, and I'm on the policy side, although I understand we're coming together here towards the end of our work. And we've been talking in that task force about the real challenge of how do we protect free speech and also build an environment in which everyone feels free to speak. That's the great tension. I thought we would be there more today, and I'm pleased that my expectations were actually both affirmed, because we were talking at that level, and then we were talking much more about our own institution and how free speech and community and the safety of our students is actually very much related to how faculty feel together about their own positions and administrators and staff and graduate students. So that's been surprising and I think really important. I wanted to go back to what Takeo and Crystal were saying in our very first session this morning about how we can think of students as co-producers of knowledge and extend that to, of course, our graduate students straddling the divide between worker and student, also staff members. And one thing that I've been wondering is if we haven't, as faculty and administrators, the two hats that I think I'm wearing on this panel, if we haven't in some ways exaggerated those tensions, if maybe the faculty administrators and staff are a little more worried than the students are, even though students are so often characterized as snowflakes or educated sheep or complainers or whiners, I'm not finding that, even though that language is out there. And I want to give you an example that I think illustrates very well what Daniel Kleinman said earlier, and that I think has been happening all day today, which is probably a bad quote, excuse me, Daniel, that we need to see our shared world from the perspective of the other. And I think this is the great value of the humanities, and what I've been watching my students do in my classes in really powerful ways, and also outside of my classes. So I want to give you one quick story. Last week at a conference on forced displacement, generously supported by the BU Center for Humanities, by the way, we staged a reading of a Palestinian Chilean playwright's work called A Stone's Throw. And in it, you hear a monologue from an imprisoned Palestinian stone thrower, a young boy, and the experience of being in prison. And when I presented to the staff at Killitan Honors College that we were going to do this event, they asked me if we needed police there. And I said, no. How could we need police at this reading? And that was very sad to me that this concern would come up. But I was actually a little bit worried. And what happened at the end of this play was remarkable. A student asked, and this was such a brave question, a student asked, what's going on in Palestine? And everyone was sort of like, oh boy, where do we start? The playwright who was there and one of the readers started in a really interesting place, and I think very important place, with settler colonialism and apartheid, and told that story of Palestine. And another student raised his hand and said, I understand all of that, but my Jewish father would start in 1948 and the Holocaust. And the playwright said, well, yes, and my Israeli family members who are settlers would start here with this story. And it was an amazing moment where this conversation, I mean, it was the conversation everyone was worried about. And it's actually the conversation that Takeo was talking about earlier as being afraid to have before tenure. We seem not able to talk about that and feel safe. The conversation went on with the audience, students, and the playwright and the participants in this reading taking different positions, not necessarily their own, taking different perspectives on this terrible conflict. And it did not devolve into fighting at all. They continued to talk through it. We certainly didn't need police officers there. And it was a moment where I saw the power of humanistic inquiry, of pushing us outside, maybe also of theater, of pushing us outside of our own perspective and seeing things from another perspective. And it gave me the most hope about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that I've had in a really, really long time, because I saw these students engaging with different perspectives and talking across these divides. And as I watched the panels here today, I felt like that was actually happening in some ways. We were listening to each other. We were recognizing the positions of the others, recognizing the way we straddle positions. And so I hope that we can continue to do that at all levels that we find ourselves in the university, and that we can also trust our students that they're able to do that, because they certainly showed my staff and myself that was possible in that event. Thank you.
Thank you to all our speakers. As moderator, I'm going to throw out three questions here, somewhat targeted at individuals, but anyone can feel free to answer any question they'd like. And after we have some discussion, then we'll invite questions from the audience, either through Slido or at the microphones. So one question that I had, and this was spurred by the comments from Julie and David, is can we speak across power differentials, and if so, how? Given the hierarchy in the university, and assuming that that hierarchy will never be completely leveled, how can we best speak across those divides? A second question I have, and this is maybe for Will and Adela, is what role do the humanities play in helping us speak to each other? Given the history of the humanities, given the interdisciplinary work of some humanities units, do the humanities have a particular role to play in offering guidance for how we speak to each other? And then my final question could be for Carrie, but really could be for anyone as well. It's spurred by a quote from Walt Whitman in Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, where he says, what is it then between us? And he means two things by that. The first is, what barriers are between us? What is interposing between us? But he also means what connects us, what links us, what is it between us? And he assumes an us. And I think quite rightfully so, a lot of the discussions today have focused on divides and divisions and chasms and difficulties. But I also wonder what common assumptions do we have, and how might that be a basis for constructive dialogue between us, and also constructive ways of changing structures within the university. So I'll leave those three out there and let people answer as they see fit.
Well, if I may speak to your first question, can we talk across these hierarchies? I think the answer currently from my position is not really. There have been multiple times when I have brought my concerns to what I deemed to be the appropriate authority and had them dismissed and not been sure where to go. So what do I, as a graduate student in that position, do? Do I immediately escalate things to the next available ombud? Is there nowhere else for me to be? I think that this is exacerbated by the way that the hierarchies are currently laid out and the power differential being so stark. There are other ways to do this. There are other ways to imagine this. And when I said earlier that I think we're taking the wrong lesson from the corporate world, I did actually have something in mind. I have a good friend who's done a bunch of research for his own company on how to foster good feedback and feedback across power divides. And there are already methods out there that we could be using. The end of year review, for example, has been found to be inefficient. Reviews of that nature don't really tell us what we want to know. You don't get good change that way. Instead, what they might do is they have an incentive program, almost like the giving of extra credit for corrections, where it is encouraged within the system to have individual one-on-one chats of, hey, I noticed this thing in the moment or just after the moment that it happens. Can we talk about it right now? You know, these things exist and we don't have to make them up.
About the first question and then about the second one, I think, like, from a Marxist point of view, I don't think you can. From the perspective of the capitalist system, where our university and in general our Western societies work, I would say that it's very important to see what are the goals of the university, the mission of the university. And I think that the question was asked by a graduate student to the provost, and the provost mentioned the strategic plan and a committee, but did not go really in depth about this question. And I think that question is very important, because when you are fundraising and you have this great success, it has been a great success for the university, but for the small goals or missions that the many constituencies within the university, if you don't see the benefits and how your small goals tied up with the big mission of the university, then maybe you cannot talk. And I believe that you can convince the higher, you know, the people who are leading the university of why you are important within those goals if you have a clear idea. And I think that sometimes when the bureaucracy grows, you don't. And then you are part of a system like a small chain and you don't really know the big. And I think this is a common frustration in general. I don't know about if you're
going to... Done?
Yeah.
So one of the unacknowledged legacies of the early university that I think we continue to carry the baggage of, and that doesn't really work in the Marxist breakdown between worker and capitalist or worker and manager, is the idea of the vocation, right? That you do what you do as a calling, and that the university is a place for people with a calling, and that goes hand in hand with monasticism and impoverishment. Right, that we're all supposed to be sleeping on hard beds and eating crusts of bread and water, and if we're lucky, it's gotten moldy and we get psychedelic dreams out of it, right? But that idea that we do what we do because it's a calling and because we don't have any other choice leads to the impoverished wages that we're all complaining about, and that there's the idea that, you know, if you are a successful novitiate, you'll become a full member of the order, which also comes out of monasticism, too strongly continues to structure our understanding of the graduate education that goes along with also the apprenticeship idea, that you're a journeyman. I mean, you're an apprentice until you become a journeyman and you've got complete control of your craft, and then you become a master craftsman. So these are all the kinds of structures that are embedded within the university system that need to be reformed and do not necessarily work in the modern world, and that we have now a new vision of the university as being something else than it was, but we still have this baggage left over.
I'll take a crack.
Sure.
I'm kind of pessimistic, mm-hmm. frankly. In order for there to be effective, useful communication across the divides that we've been talking about, we're dependent upon those with the upper hand having goodwill, a prudent conception of what the long-range interests are of the university, and respect for others. And that is very often lacking. We find it now in our own experience. Many people in the university, I think, are of unusual character. Many people in the university, for example, could make a lot more money if they were doing other kinds of work. Nevertheless, the divides are so strong and the power differential is so great that it's very difficult to see how the communication could be useful across those divides. We have found some help ourselves, that is the adjuncts, for example, and the full-time non-tenure-track faculty, in resorting to unions. If you have a good union, you're well represented, and you have a certain amount of leverage. But that's not available, for example, in private universities, according to quirks in American law, for faculty with respect to the administration. Staff, however, are in another situation. And they might be able to gain more leverage if they were unionized. I'll just finish with one anecdote, semi-anecdote. I was a department chair at Cornell for 7 years. It was a good department in many ways. It was very democratically run. When I was chair of the department, I felt I was one among equals. But it was democratic in the sense in which Athens was democratic. You had a democracy of those who were in charge. That is within the department, not within the university at large. And the most difficult problems and the most difficult to resolve problems that I had to deal with during those 7 years was the relationship between the faculty and the staff. The faculty simply were not considerate. They did not respect staff. And these were good people, generally speaking. But they didn't know how to function within a multi-tiered situation. So I am a little pessimistic. I'd love to have answers to that question that were more satisfying.
So what is it then between us? I think it's what we've been talking about, but I would just reframe it at the negative part as being, in fact, a class system that we don't really often acknowledge as such outside of a forum like this. And even then, it's much more complicated than, I mean, it's not working class has come up, privileged class. It's more complicated than that because it has deep within it a hierarchy of esteem or the ability that David is talking about to acknowledge the labor when it's different from faculty labor and how important it is and how all the things that the staff members on the panels have revealed. So it's a very complicated class system, and I think in the US we like to think of ourselves as a classless society, and I think the university has embraced that even more than beyond, even as we study class all the time, even as we teach about class in our classrooms, I think we ignore the unique class system at the university. But what is it then between us, beyond the divide? What brings us together? Why, for example, do we work here when some of us, not me, I don't think, but when some of us could make more money elsewhere? What is between us is the students. That's what I arrived at a long time ago. I mean, there were thoughts that this was a sort of calling, humanistic inquiry, my research, my creativity. But actually, I think why most of us stay here is for the students. And I think that's true of faculty, and I think it's why staff stay here, because they could make more money elsewhere, because they love the students. They want to make this place run for the students. And the graduate students who are teaching or mentoring in a lab, I think, share that desire to offer the undergraduates a great experience. And I hope that we extend that same appreciation and make that the thing between us in improving graduate student lives here too. So I think that's why we're here. That's why I stay and want to be part of a university. It's because of the students.
About the humanities and interdisciplinarity, and I'm going to try to answer this question with modesty, following Gina Shapiro's advice. I have learned a lot from my colleagues in political science and in economics, having been the director of the Center of Latin American Studies. But what I think the humanities does is that brings critical thinking, but also the awareness of why is it important to think in an abstract level, but also in a very concrete level. And For instance, I was in a policy paper exam. I was invited. I don't have any idea about the policy. How do you do make policy? But I was there because it was about Mexico. And I noticed that the student didn't speak Spanish, had never been to Mexico, didn't have a clue of the history of Mexico, and was talking about a region he didn't even know was a state. And this was very, for me, very surprising, because the whole argument about how to implement policy was based on some technical idea of policy making. And I thought that that was strange, because you are still going to be dealing with people if you don't know how those people think, what the culture is, had at least a slightest idea of their history, you cannot implement any policy, in my opinion. So I think the humanities are central for any exchange of any exchange in human relations. That's what I think.
Can I piggyback on that really quickly? What I wanted to say, and I don't know that I said this clearly, about the theatrical event I was describing, is that on a really basic level, I think the humanities teach us about other people's perspectives. When we're reading a novel or a poem or reading theater, performing theater, we're in different roles, and it gets us outside of ourselves and allows us to consider the other. And so in a really basic way, I think the humanities helps us in that sense.
Thank you. Love to hear some questions or comments from the audience. So you can use Slido or come on up to one of the microphones.
May I?
Yes, please.
And quickly, I'd like to add to Carrie's mention of students, colleagues. I mean, that too, I get very lonely during the summers, and I dislike sabbaticals, though I'll probably take my next one anyway. but what I would like to address, I would like to expand Will's model, that was an expansion of mine, understanding it as the question of what the advantages and disadvantages are of modernization. I mean, you know, when feudalism was replaced by post-feudalism or democracy or whatever it is, as Marx said, you lose the personal nexus, you gain the cash nexus. That has advantages and disadvantages. With your model of Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft, which I'm afraid I'm going to have to claim for the Germans, you have a feeling of, it's a similar feeling of loss of something, but gain of something. And it's a romantically tinged feeling of loss of something, of gain of something. And the third model that I would apply, which is a little more complicated, bear with me, is something that happened in the German territories in 1814 after Napoleon was kicked out. Jurists were faced with the question of whether to replace the Code Napoleon in occupied areas with German common law, keep the Code Napoleon, and do some sort of hybrid thing. And that was really a question about whether enlightened universalist reason could predict all human situations, or whether perhaps local cultures on the ground had some wisdom to them as well, which is a problem that repeats itself in the relationship of administration and faculty, when administration has some bright idea, imposing it downward on people who have been doing something forever in some way, and causing mayhem, but possibly with beneficial purpose or outcome. So in the case of 1814, a great debate arose with romantic jurists arguing for preservation of ancient laws, or Roman law, really, against revolutionary law. And the what's complicated about this is that codification has its benefits. I mean, you know, you know what the laws are, you can appeal to them, versus, you know, some duke tells you what you can do or not do, and you can't appeal to the laws. On the other hand, codification has its disadvantages. I mean, my last major syllabus was 16 pages single-spaced. And, you know, the syllabus has become a contract. and sort of restrictive and time consuming. So I think you know, this movement has both its advantages and its disadvantages, and we're best served probably by sorting that out. I don't know if that was a question or an observation.
Didn't sound like a question.
I guess I keep thinking of this this historical referent to an older vision of the university, and wondering which university you mean. There are so many to choose from. But I'm also really caught by this idea of apprenticeship, and I've had a conversation with a professor in my own department about the problems of apprenticeship as I see it. Apprenticeship can be really great. Some of these older systems can be really great. But the failure points are, I think, what we're talking about here. The weak points are what we need to address. And apprenticeship, in a lot of ways, is failing us whenever an instructor doesn't have time for us or doesn't have the training to train us. I think addressing sort of that historical context for our systems is perhaps only useful to elucidate our current problems.
Right. I was not saying that I had an answer. You know, academics are not supposed to come up with answers. Academics are just supposed to talk around the problem. Mm-hmm.
I would like an answer to how I'm supposed to live on a grad student wage. That would be nice.
You're not going to get it today. Apprenticeship does fail. There are failures, and I feel that very intensely. I feel it particularly intensely when something happens and one of the doctoral students in my program has to withdraw for one reason or another. You know, and I always hope it's not because of a failure of mentorship or apprenticeship. Human systems do fail, and codification works towards that. But even when you have things codified, things fail. And we've been talking throughout the day about remuneration, or how people get paid for the work that they do, and incentive systems. And one of the terrible things, I think, is that kind of mentorship and apprenticeship is not one of the things that gets codified into the incentive system, right? And as Carrie said, I think most of the faculty are here for the students, but sometimes the way BU is structured, the students fall out of the equation because that's not what the priority for the financial remuneration is. And I wish there was a way we could figure out to solve that.
You want to go first?
Jeffrey?
Yes. No? Yes. What can we do when we can't talk, or when talk is only beginning? I want to offer two suggestions and invite panelists and others to come up with partial strategies. One is finding locations of creativity, I would argue, and another is awareness of the silences caused by denials and defeats. In terms of locations of creativity, I would like to suggest and even urge tenured faculty to experiment with the possibility of saying no to things that we might think are less valuable or important, so as to make space for creating activities that we do think are valuable and important. Now, that's a delicate balancing act, but I think there is some power in having tenure, even if, as we've also said, there are vulnerabilities. So I want to suggest that. And the other is, in terms of denials and who cannot speak, there's a very, and I mentioned this a bit before, but wanted to put it on the table, there's a very courageous junior faculty woman who went out of her way to document gender pay disparities in her department and made addressing those in a systemic way part of a retention package for a job that she was offered subsequently. Well, she's leaving, because the answer was no. There will be no systemic addressing. So what I want to point out is that the person most willing to take on power is leaving, and institutions of power do have the capacity to encourage people to leave, and I think we need to listen for the silences either of people who leave or people who have been made to be quiet. And I think those not as metaphorical ideas, but as concrete strategies, and want to encourage other thoughts about concrete strategies.
No response to that great observation. I actually am preempting my 5 o'clock remarks, and I was thinking maybe we could just keep going if people have more questions. But I wanted to respond right away to Carrie's point and also to Will's, because it struck me, I wanted to build on Carrie's observation that a humanities perspective provides access to other people's points of view, and it seems to me that that's exactly what this exercise today has been, that garnered through this exercise is access to many points of view that we haven't necessarily heard, possibly ever, at this institution. But one of the things that has struck me as I've been listening over the course of the day is that we've been focusing more on our institutional positions as the impetus and motivation behind our perspectives. But it seems to me that our status as humanities people and scholars explains much of what we've been discussing. And, for example, in thinking about Will's model of a kind of monastic graduate education, the other model is the model of the gentleman scholar. And the idea, from the 40s and the 50s, the pre-GI Bill era was that you didn't have to pay graduate students, high wages or salaries or anything because they were all wealthy. And I think one of the fears that I've heard people express in today's university is that we may be entering, an era when only elites are able to major in humanities and pursue doctorates in the humanities because, it's simply not a livable wage. And more importantly, I still think that one of the big issues behind this strong sense of really, it seems to me almost tragic the way people were the expressions of concern about their status as graduate students today. I think that was the most striking thing, and it's what I'm hearing most from people about sort of in the aftermath of our panels, just being struck by how wounded and undefended our graduate students feel. And, it does seem to me that one of the big issues underlying this is the fact that, the idea of an apprenticeship or a vocation really is evaporating. The larger world is not, there's been, almost an absolute inversion of tenure track jobs, versus adjuncts. What is it, 75% to 25% now? It used to be, when I was coming out of graduate school, 25% of the jobs were adjunct and 75% were tenure track. Those realities, it seems to me, are impacting on people's senses of who they are, what roles they play in the institution, their status as workers versus apprentices, or, people with an academic future. You could argue that in a way, the biggest lie that we tell our graduate students is that, they can have lives like ours, and they can, look forward to fruitful academic careers. So, and this may be too strong and too negative, because I've heard a lot of inspiring and optimistic ideas set out here, and obviously I agree with all of them. But I do think these are things that are worth considering. The ways in which some of the concerns and problems we've been setting out have been in some ways symptomatic of larger status issues for the humanities. Even the issue, I would say, of diversity that came up in the first panel. One of the things I was wondering about is our fields that are especially identified with diversity and with, the Socratic method, the ones that are losing students. Students are running in flight to STEM fields and to practical majors where none of the things that we especially value are staged and prioritized and privileged. So, again, I think this question of the status of the humanities is really crucial to all the things we've been discussing.
I have two anecdotes that I want to share in response to that. The first is about the coming into the humanities. I was once at a big classics conference, the annual one in January, and there was a talk by an FBI recruiter. I wondered what the heck that was about, so I went to go see it. And the FBI recruiter said, "We want you. You are the people who have been trained to speak. You are the people who have been trained to think critically. You are the people who will notice discrepancies." So I think that parts of the non-academic world are catching on to the fact that, hey, humanities have a value, but it's hard to convey that on a larger cultural level, and it's hard to convey that sometimes to students. And I said earlier that you don't come into a PhD in the classics without being pretty sure. And I say that partially because of that sentiment, but partially because 3 times before I came into this degree, I got the talk from a professor. The talk that says there are no jobs. The talk that says only crazy people do this. You will make no money. You will live on nothing. And you will be scrambling to teach your classes. They were not wrong. They said don't do this. They were not wrong. But they also were not right. We're here for a reason. And I think you're absolutely right that that reason is the students.
So I've got, my version of the talk is that my undergraduate degree was in folklore and mythology, and one of my friend's fathers, this is a friend who actually went on to be a Japanese historian, so he was just as guilty of being a liberal arts scholar or an academic as I was. But this father, every time I saw him, he would ask me about mythical zoology and how I was going to make a living with a degree in mythical zoology. I mean, he just thought it was his laugh line every time I ran into him. And yet, here I am, and in many ways I feel as though my folklore and mythology undergraduate put me on the track that has me sitting here today. So I think there can be positive stories. And I just wanted to also talk about Susan Mizruki's idea about the gentleman grad student. In one of my jobs as a consultant, I ended up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan talking to people about copper mining. And it turned out that the owner of the largest copper mine in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, somebody who was notorious for being a strike breaker and pitting the Finnish workers against the Cornish workers, was Alexander Agassiz, the son of the great racist biologist Louis Agassiz, and who also was a faculty member teaching biology at Harvard and funding his career as a biologist by owning a copper mine. So this is also the reality of the mythical university I was talking about, that part of that vocation is that it's open to people of privilege who have the means to be able to do and live the life of the mind. And it may be foolish of us to think that we can make a living doing the life of the mind.
Let's have one last question or comment, Aaron. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you over there. Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks. My name's Brian Barone. I'm a PhD candidate in musicology and ethnomusicology. And the conversation has moved a bit from this, but I want to maybe take you back to the last round or so of comments that you all made and observe that the way I might gloss where it feels that many of you arrived was at the identification of the cruel optimism, for you literature people, that maybe structures our relationship to the university, right? These affective investments we have in the idea of the life of the mind, in the idea of ourselves as scholars, in the idea of the student-teacher relationship that perversely bind us to institutions and practices that are deeply harmful to many, many people, many of us. And as that demystification of optimism would do, it left you all feeling pessimistic. It left a lot of us feeling pessimistic. And so I wanted to ask, what might happen if we begin from pessimism? What might happen if we don't rebuild optimism, as maybe a few of the last questions have asked you to do? I want to ask you to do the opposite. And the price of beginning from pessimism, I think, is often radicalism. I think of one leading Afro-pessimist scholar who, in my reading anyway, calls for the end of the world. And there's a heavy weight to pessimism, but I wonder if I can ask you to begin from pessimism to look ahead. What would beginning from pessimism to find a way forward do for all of you? Thanks.
Well, I'll take a stab at that, since I was the one who actually talked about pessimism. I said I was pessimistic about the possibility of reforming, of bridging some of those divides. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to continue to teach students what I think is worth teaching. I'm going to continue to teach graduate students what they think is worth working on, which I think they're right about. I'm going to continue to be active in the union, because I think that provides us with some help, some hope for improvement. I'm going to continue to be active politically, as I have been for the last 70 years. And I will take what opportunities there are to try to make things better. And there's never any guarantee that we will succeed, but there is a guarantee that we'll fail if we don't succeed, if we don't try.
So my colleagues are going to laugh. I've never been accused of being a pessimist in my life. So this is really interesting. But I also, if I'm starting from the pessimist position, I end up back in an optimistic position again. But if I'm starting from there, there's no place else outside of here I'd rather be. You know, I have a partner who works in business. That is not a place that I want to be at all. Like Adela, I feel like I have flourished here, and I'm very, very invested in this institution, and I believe in the power of education. And so that's the optimist side. But the pessimist side is that there's no place else for us in some way. I want to be here. I don't want to go anywhere else.
Since Susan has seated her closing remarks, is that correct, Susan?
Yeah, well, I'm just going to say thank you. Okay.
I was going to say something about...
Please, go ahead, Adela.
I think I'm going to go with Jeff with building creative spaces of communication, and I think the day has 12 hours, then 12 hours we sleep, and most of the day we do things we don't want to do. But I think the hours we invest in reading a text you love, in teaching a class you love, and in engaging with a student who actually kind of like gave you a great, sharp, new perspective of what you're doing, it has the meaning of why you are doing this. And I think if we assume that we are going to start with the precariousness of the humanities within today's society, maybe that's a good start, because precisely because the humanities are precarious right now is because we can struggle and we can like fight for them. So I think that's where we should stand.
Shall I say one more thing?
Go right ahead.
I just wanted to disagree with the idea that there's no other place. Before I got my college degree, I worked in industry. I also studied engineering, which I liked very much. And I don't think I would have been unhappy if I had been an engineer. I also became a machinist. I became a skilled machinist. And I liked that work very much. In the particular job that I left, that is the last job I had as a machinist, I worked with crews of people. And I liked working with crews of people, cooperating together, And I realized when I gave up that work that I was giving something up that I probably would not have again if I became an academic. I also worked in an engineering department as a design draftsman. I designed structures that I saw built and that stayed up. It was very rewarding work. I worked with other good engineers. There are a lot of things that we can do that are very rewarding. Academia is not the only thing. I'm not prepared to leave academia. I don't see any reason to, in fact, I'm too old to leave academia. But there are other things to do. However, we shouldn't draw students into academia with the false assurance that they're going to be employed in it. If they're determined to do it, regardless, that's another story. And then we should nurture them.
So on that note, Susan will say a few words, but on behalf of myself and the roundtable, thank you all for coming. Thanks to all the organizers. And, here is Susan.